Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, sound editors, sound mixers, VFX gurus, stuntmen, stunt coordinators, composers, authors, you name it, and we talk to them. And lots and lots and lots of talking we've been doing on air and also with pre-recorded interviews. Got a lot of potential of award contenders coming up for you that I've been working on. Maybe next month you'll hear some of those as we get closer to awards season for nominations for Guild Awards, things like that. But a lot of good stuff coming down the pike, and good stuff today. Of course, first, let me say good stuff last week with my friend Scott Hoover, entertainment journalist, longtime colleague, friend, and now book author with Beverly Hills Noir. Get it. You will not be disappointed. Classic film fans, I think you're really going to appreciate quite a few of the stories in there. But for everybody that likes true crime with a blend of Hollywood, and it's worth buying the book just to see a picture of Alfred Hitchcock being led into a jail cell. So that is another pitch for Scott and his book. It's in bookstores, in the brick and mortars, it's online. Get it. You will love it. Another thing, with Halloween coming, it is spooky season, folks. Don't forget about seeing the wonderful family film Treasure Tracker and, of course, Monster Summer. My interview with director David Henry, of course, you know him better as an actor, from Wizards of Waverly Place, How I Met Your Mother. David delivers a wonderful spooky family film filled with adventure in Monster Summer. The interview is up now on behindthelensonline.net. Check it out. And it's such a fun movie, a great cast of young kids. And that's what makes David the perfect director for that. Having been a child actor himself and knowing how to navigate the system, and also knowing now as a director what that magic spark is he needs in kids as actors for certain roles, and also to mesh them together in an ensemble. And of course, Mel Gibson, and I will see Mel Gibson in anything and everything. And I love Mel in this role. Lorraine Bracco is there as well. Just Monster Summer. It is in theaters right now. So check that out. You know, these are two fun family films that everybody in the family can see, young, old, just filled with adventure, have that great 90s vibe film of things like The Goonies. So Halloween is coming. And then for those who really like the scares, do not overlook my friend Larry Fessenden and his film Blackout, which is now available on DVD and Blu-ray. I love this film. Love it, love it, love it. It is Larry directed, wrote, and he is so gifted at horror, at terror. And, you know, now we've got werewolf transformations happening. It's such a beautifully done film, though. The cinematic elements are spectacular. But do not overlook that. And, of course, be on the lookout, people, digitally, coming this month, Catnado. Perfect, perfect to freak you out for the month of October, for the spooky season. And of course, you know, one of my favorites. Campy, cheesy, Sharkula. You gotta love it. How can you not love a shark that transforms into Dracula? It's to die for. So there are a few little plugs there for some things that I really like in this spooky season. Plus Scott's book. His book's not spooky, but it has some spooky stuff in it with some murders. But today, big doings today. You know, I'm never one to shy away from hot button documentaries and subjects. And anybody that has known me any length of time, if you've been listening to the show for 10 years, if you've been reading my reviews and interviews for the past 42 plus years, you know, I don't shy away from hot buttons. And yeah, I've pushed quite a few of them myself over the years. So today, we're going to be pushing some buttons when writer-director Ruth Lightman joins me at the midpoint of the show to talk about her new documentary, No One Asked You. This is an amazing documentary, and she teams up with comedian Liz Winstead. And this is a six and a half, seven-year journey, that takes a look at the abortion issue, but from a different perspective than anything we've seen before. This documentary takes a look at and supports the workers at the abortion clinics, the workers who have escorted women into clinics, the abuse that they have taken, the violence that they have faced, the challenges that they have had to meet over the years. And the documentary takes us all the way up through the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade. There's some great stuff in here. And what's so fun is we see this through Liz Winstead's eyes. And if you don't know, Liz is a co-creator of The Daily Show. Gives you an idea of her irreverent comedy stylings. She's also founder of Abortion Access Front. And she uses comedy. She uses humor to... Oh, wait. Pam, what are we doing here? We have who? Put me... Okay, Pam's got to pop me on hold first. I got to find out what's happening here. We have something unknown happening here. So I've got to... Pam just hung up on somebody. Pop me on hold, Pam.
Babes, what are you doing?
What? I'm just mowing the lawn.
No, it's blazing hot and dry out here. Don't you remember? Smokey Bear says.
Avoid using power equipment when it's windy or dry.
Where'd you learn this?
Oh, it's on
SmokeyBear.com with many other wildfire prevention tips.
Right. Thanks, Honey Bear.
Because remember, only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Electronics Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org.
And this is the joys of live anything, people. That was actually Vivian Kerr, filmmaker of her second film, her sophomore film, Seance. She's so anxious to be on the show. She called in today when she is actually going to be here next Monday. At 11 o'clock. So make sure you tune in next Monday. I'm very excited to speak with Vivian next week. I reviewed her first film 2 years ago. And since then, she has been, and I was one of the first people to, I might have been the first person to review it. And since then, she's been working on her follow-up film, Seance. And so I'm very excited that to be able to follow Vivian from film to film. So she's going to join us next week. But I'm so tickled that she was so anxious she thought she was on today. So anyway, getting back to No One Asked You, We're going to talk in detail about it when Ruth joins us at the midpoint of the show. But needless to say, Liz Winstead, who is the feature, who it's her POV that we see the documentary through, and the whole idea is humor. Humor is as a means to deal with situations and to convey and to educate and entertain people and get them to understand and get involved in things. So, can't wait to talk to Ruth. But first, you're going to hear my exclusive interview with writer-director Michael Felker, who has a wonderful, interesting new film out called Things Will Be Different. It is actually his first narrative feature. He began this journey many years ago, and then he reworked it, rewrote it. It became Things Will Be Different. He'd done a lot of shorts, but so Mouton has now moved into the feature film realm, and it's a really interesting premise. The official synopsis is: in order to escape police after a robbery, two estranged siblings, a brother and a sister, lay low in a metaphysical farmhouse that hides them away in a different time. There, they reckon with a mysterious force that pushes their familial bonds to unnatural breaking points. Things will be very different in this film as we watch the dynamic between the brother and sister develop, as we see these cryptic puzzles and clues within this farmhouse happen, as we see the metaphysical influences and confluences unfold. Really well done. It's very cinematic. The location is perfect. It is just, Michael did a wonderful, wonderful job on this. So, what we're probably going to end up doing is hearing the first half of Michael's interview, then joining Ruth, and then at the end of the show, we'll go back and finish Michael's interview. And Pam's nodding her head. So hopefully the rest of the show will go as planned. So without any further ado, take a listen to my exclusive interview with Michael Felker talking about Things Will Be Different. Hello, Michael Felker.
Hi, Debbie. How's it going?
It's going. How's it going with you?
Good, good, good. Just getting ready for our premiere tonight. So I'm glad I'm able to come on over to this call and chat with you for a little bit.
I'm so excited that you are able to do it. This is quite an interesting feature narrative directorial debut.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Things Will Be Different is a film that I call a pay attention film.
That sounds about right.
You need to pay attention. This isn't just a typical, oh, we robbed a bank, we did this, we did that, we're on the run, we're hiding out. That's not what's happening here. We get the first parts okay, but once we hide out, Joseph and Sydney, this becomes anything but a run-of-the-mill film.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice to hear, actually. I try not to make a run-of-the-mill movies if I can't help it.
You did really good with setting this up, with this story, with the intrigue throughout once they get to the farmhouse and the property. And you really want to pay attention to what's happening. And we're fascinated as we go through. It's like the house is empty. The cupboards are bare. But, oh, wait. Let me open that cupboard again. And it's full. Oh, there's nothing in the refrigerator and I'm dying of thirst. Oh, let's open that door again. Oh, it's filled. I wish my refrigerator was that full sometimes.
We all wish we could just open our empty fridge, close it, and then open it up again to find a bunch of food and drink in there, for sure.
And not just have a bunch of stuff, but the stuff that you want to eat, drink, whatever.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah.
I want it custom made for me.
I want a whole row of just nothing but hummus and salsa so I could then pull out my pantry and get nothing but chips. That's what my my pantry.
Oh, see?
Where it would be.
See? I want frozen cheesesteaks direct from Philly in the freezer so I can take them out and pop them in the microwave for a minute, and they'll be nice and gooey and fabulous.
Oh, my God. That sounds incredible. I should do that today for lunch.
That, now, see, that, you do a sequel, and that could be a really good twist.
Exactly, exactly. Is that someone opens up the fridge, gets their frozen cheese sticks, and then be able to microwave and go, all right, it's like a little mini short film / commercial.
That's it. That's it. But you keep us really intrigued with the signs on the door and the safe and the key and the locks and the voice on the tape recorder. You have all these little intricacies interwoven here, and they're not throwaways. They're directly relevant to the story that's unfolding. So I'm curious. I know that you wanted to make a film that your dad would like, which is very important, I think, so that you know that you have an audience already besides yourself. That you're making it for one person, because if that person is going to like it, you know there are other people like that who are like him out there that are going to like it too.
100%.
So you followed one of the cardinal tenets. Know your demographic. Know your target audience. And you and you know your audience for this film.
Yeah, I feel like my goal with this was just to make a movie that he would like and everything else be damned in a weird way. But more importantly, though, you nailed on the head, is like if he likes it, then there's going to be other people of his ilk, which are just like, you know, thoughtful moviegoers who like to be challenged in some science fiction and a good time. And they will come and watch it too and enjoy it hopefully as well.
How challenging was it for you developing this story with the intricacies that you have placed and peppered throughout, which, by the way, are all paced really well, and I attribute that to your skills as an editor.
Oh, thank you. I learned from, you know, working a lot with the filmmaking duo Benson and Moorhead, who also work within, you know, sci-fi, thriller, horror space.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the key for me when developing this was knowing the world so inside and out, at least in my own brain, that then I can then concentrate on what we should show versus not show and still leave it interesting and thought-provoking, but not, you know, being too incredibly opaque and not being too incredibly knowing where everybody knows how the rules work. It's like trying to find this middle ground where hopefully there's intrigue and questions, and still being able to latch onto our characters who are, for the most part, just locked in our same perspective as an audience.
Mm-hmm. Going along with this, as you're figuring all that out, you've got to worry about your timeline as well, because time and space is very important here. Are we on the same plane, astral plane? Are we somewhere else? Are we in a mirrored world? So you've got your timeline happening here, but your timeline of events also has to hit the emotional beats that keep us engaged. So I'm curious, you know, how challenging was that to figure out that timeline and those beats? Because that's something that you can't do on paper.
I totally 100% understand. I mean, what really helped me was leaning on my expertise as an editor, which basically is just taking a bunch of footage all scattered out throughout different times, non-linear elements, and trying to make a cohesive linear story. I mean, that's just the broad sense of working it as an editor for any type of storytelling visually.
Sure.
How do I take all these pieces and make something emotionally resonant and engaging in a linear format? So thinking about that, I've had this world for a while and these intricacies for a while, but it wasn't until I, you know, followed up with this story about this brother and sister estrangement and just this, like, you know, time just slowly, like, drifting them apart, and then they're getting more and more strained and more untrusting of each other, and using that, like, strained relationship and putting it through this world to really push it to its breaking point. So, yeah, it wasn't until I figured out the heart of it and then everything else worked within service for that heart, knowing the world and rules pretty well by then, too.
I love how we see rules unfolding, and especially as Sydney is really figuring them out. She's the one who's really figuring them out. She's determined to figure out where the heck they are and why the heck they're there. And everything that she goes through, finding stuff in the attic, going through newspaper, volumes and boxes of stuff, the kind of stuff you would expect to find in an old farmhouse that had been in a family for generations that appears to now be abandoned, but very well kept. So I love that aspect. And the fact that you make Sydney the one, I think a lot of filmmakers and writers would have gone the other way and had Joseph be the one.
Yeah, no, I could see that for sure. It's actually kind of like an interesting point for us because we just know that, like, because of Joe's character, he's just going off the whim and trusting, like, his instincts and his intuition to get us through the situation, but it's not thought out, and it's what drives Sydney away from him, and the only way she can get out is by figuring things out, digging deep, and hoping to find answers in order to get back home. And it's that strain of there's two ways to watch the movies. It's two ways that Joseph and Sydney engage with the story as well. You can either dive in like Sydney and go through all this paperwork and all these boxes and hope to find an answer, but only find 10 more questions. Or you can be like Joseph, curse the sky above you and go like, what's going on? I have no idea. This is terrible. And then lock yourself away. So, it's a dynamic that I think is like how I wrestle with a lot of science fiction movies, literature, what have you. And it's very relatable to have those two sides of the coin as a human engaging with tricky narrative like this.
Yeah, and you do it really well. You do it really well. Now, one of the elements here, obviously, the farmhouse. It is a character in this film. It is the third prong to Sydney and Joe.
Absolutely. I love that place. I always treat like movies like this where they're contained in one location. You have to treat them like a third character or another character that has its own behavior and rules and world that it's lived in as well.
And something that I particularly like about this location, this farmhouse, is all that land around it. And then you've got wooded areas beyond that. And your DP, Carissa Dorson, she really... I like the palette. I like the visual grammar that you're using, differentiating between the exteriors, the interiors. You use the exterior wide shots to great advantage.
Thank you. She would really love to hear. I'll tell her that for sure, because we worked very, very closely in pre-production to make sure not only did we have the palette and look decided before we even shot anything and put into the camera while we shot, we even... instead of doing storyboards, we did photo boards, and me and her just walked around the property, and I stood in for where actors would be.
Mm-hmm.
We shot the movie in advance with the angles we wanted. So a lot of really thought out visuals for us on our end, for sure.
It comes into play really well in terms of the mystic, the supernatural element here of what we're dealing with time travel and the whole astral plane, mirroring, this kind of stuff. Because it lets you avoid a lot of expensive visual effects, special effects.
Right.
Having that wide screen, that vista of the property, you've got that one, you've got the great moments where trying to flee, run,
yeah,
and then this wall, this just shimmering wall stops you.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a more contained space that you were doing this in, I think it would have involved a lot more visual effects and a lot more money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was one of the things, like, that's one of our favorite moments while shooting the movie was shooting that sequence. We had not as much time and money getting through the shoot as we were going on, so Chris and I just conceived, like, what if we just shot the sequence in, like, two setups, one wide and one close-up, where she's, you know, spewing up blood, is that we just use the landscape, use the greatest visual effect of all, which is just, look at how gorgeous this is, let's embrace it.
Yeah.
And then put the camera in a spot that makes it feel like, you know, the character is like an ant crawling across this landscape. Mm-hmm. And it was really just opening your eyes and being in that space for a long time helped us figure out great set pieces like that.
Hand in hand with that, then you and Carissa give us some great ECUs. You don't overpopulate the film with them. You use them very judiciously. But when it comes to things like the key, like Joe running out by a brick pillar and he's got a gun stashed inside the brick. Inside the bricks, a little cubby in there. These close-ups tell us they're more pieces of the puzzle. That's how you're using your ECUs.
Yeah, absolutely. My main thing that I try to do is, like, I just make sure to get the exact kind of coverage we need because I know this will flow together, but also it will tell us so much more about the story and the world if we put the camera in a very specific spot. So when we basically were telling our crew, all right, we're going to this next setup, we just pointed to our photo board and made sure exactly that framing and that lighting was matching just so we can really make sure that the gun can read this piece here, we can see the keyhole here, we can look at the safe and pick out more puzzles and all the documents on the bed, making sure those are like slightly legible, but just out of reach of knowing, no ability. So yeah, I'm glad you really caught on to that for sure.
And I really appreciate how you did that. Nothing there, none of those visuals, the visual grammar, dealing with close-ups, very judicious in how tight you went and what you used versus just willy-nilly. Everything was purposeful.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've worked on a lot of indie feature films, and it's just a lot of movies in my experience tend to like falter or lose their scope as soon as they don't know what to do with the camera on a set. And I think the camera is the ultimate equalizer for all budgets. Like where you put a camera and where you block your actors and who you cast are the ultimate thing that is on movies that are $1 or movies that are $100 million. And you can be inventive and be feeling like you can feel more expensive, more grand, more epic in scope if you just know what to do with where to put the camera and how to block actors.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But the other prong there is the editing, because often you can save something in editing. Which is, I think, a strong suit for you. But you very smartly, you brought in somebody else also as your editor to give you another pair of eyes.
Oh my gosh, yes. Rebecca Marquez was a lifesaver because as a director and writer and also an editor, you're so tunnel visioned in what you shot, what you had in mind. Like, you don't get to see too much of what's outside of your brain. And she brought in so much extra magical moments, especially in like conversation scenes that were like not like little moments that weren't planned or sketched out. Like she was able to flesh and find humanity in ways that I couldn't find before.
Now, did you let Rebecca do an editing pass on her own to give to give your mind a rest from the director and just let her be an editor and then you could step in?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very key for me. It's how I worked with Benson and Moorhead, which, because they are also co-editors on their movies, was that we actually had an unorthodox editing process because we shot the movie in two blocks, February of last year and August of last year. Mm-hmm. But we had to edit in between just so we can keep pace with our schedule. So she had a huge run at the movie for that was what we call the winter cut, which is everything but the summer elements.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to watch with her and not only see what she did in the cut, but she also like had these extra questions, these ideas for pickups that then she came on the set in the summer and was cutting as we were shooting the rest of the movie and putting it all together. So she was so paramount in making this movie come together in a way that was more than just what I had in my tunnel vision.
Well, and I love the fact that we do have winter, summer, we see a change of the seasons. So we know time is passing. Mm-hmm. That while Sydney and Joe may be stuck in this farmhouse and unable to leave, time is marching on. And we get to see it. And I like the contrast, the visual contrast, the color contrast. Talk to me about your color with this one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We made our what we call our lookup table, our LUT, which is like our first stab at color before we shot.
And I'm going to leave you with that little bit of tease about Michael and using the LUTs. And we will come back to Michael so that you can hear the rest, because we really get into nitty gritty on the making of Things Will Be Different. But right now, we're going to get into some real nitty gritty with a big, big welcome for Ruth Lightman. Hello, Ruth.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I am thrilled to have you. This is so wonderful. And what a documentary. No one asked you.
Well, we did ask you.
Yeah, well, of course. This is...
Yeah.
With all of the films, as I said at the top of the show, and as regular listeners know, my readers have known for decades, Hot Button, sometimes I get over-enthused about Hot Button topics. I've been known to push a few Hot Buttons myself over the years. This is one of those issues. This is one of those documentaries. And while I have had filmmakers on and we've talked about films that have dealt with abortion, that especially in light of before Roe versus Wade was in jeopardy, and then since the catastrophe happened, I've never seen a documentary with the perspective that you give us, along with Liz Winstead, where we are actually seeing the boots on the ground, quote unquote, first responders at these medical clinics. And what they go through, that's a perspective we haven't seen before. And I really love that. You can see, but you also see how the long battle wears on people. And it's not because they've lost their commitment. It's not because they don't want to help people. It's because it's just... when the slings and arrows are getting thrown at you physically as you're trying to walk a woman into a medical clinic, that beats down on you. And the way you have balanced that reality with Liz's humor and comedy is spectacularly done, so that you're educating and entertaining and setting the battleground for the next battles to come that we are in now. Just job so well done, Ruth. So well done.
Thank you so much. You know, I mean, everything that you're saying about the film is really how we want people to watch it, really. And I think that for us, it was really about things are going to get a lot worse.
Yeah.
And we need comedy and joy and levity in order to get through this together. And so, you know, when the writing was on the wall, I had met Liz several years ago, and, you know, when Trump was elected, and I knew things were about to get much worse.
Yeah.
And so I would see her on MSNBC or on some other news outlet, you know, to try to make sense of the things that never made sense. And so when that happened, it was sort of like, it was clear that I needed a lifeline. We as a culture needed a lifeline to get through this time. And that's why we followed Liz and Abortion Access Front on the Vagical Mystery Tour over 7 years through the battleground states. And we take you to the frontline workers, and it is like Liz says in the film, that no one comes there. No one was checking on them. And so, you know, there's so many different organizations that were doing work around abortion access, but none of them were doing what Liz and Abortion Access Front were doing. And I think, you know, to your point, you know, there are so many amazing documentaries out there that are, that I highly respect the filmmakers and the films of these abortion documentaries. But this is really about making a film that uses levity to talk about, so that people can really see the dismantling of our democracy in front of our eyes and, through the lens of abortion.
Yeah. And that's, and what is very interesting, because while the film is, it's pro-abortion, pro-choice, what I appreciate with some of the people that are interviewed on camera, some of them you could tell, they might not necessarily believe in abortion for themselves, but they certainly believe in the right of other people and women who need that avenue, who need that assistance. And there they are on the front lines, helping these people. And that is something that the average American, I don't think, realizes. You know, something may not be right for you personally, but you're not going to inhibit somebody else's right or need for something. And with a lot of these clinics, it's not just, they're not just abortion clinics, but they're also providing women with other medical care too.
Absolutely. Right. Right. Why is women's health care a political issue?
Yeah.
I just don't understand. I mean, and that's the thing. And I think, you know, to your point of what a lot of people in America don't understand, you know, and why, you know, Liz being at the center of the story being so important, because she is someone who has worked in the media and she's a critic of the media, and that you see in the film, and this is something that's, it's very important and specific to this film, that really calls out the mainstream media.
Yeah.
Because the mainstream media underreported on this for decades.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so that's why we have a culture of people who don't, who were surprised when the leak happened, who were surprised when Roe was overturned because of the Dobbs decision.
Well,
that shouldn't be.
No, it shouldn't be. And the thing is, you could very easily, you can very easily make a documentary just on the failure of the mainstream media and how we have devolved from real investigative journalism and reporting into what we have now, which really is a pathetic form of media coverage, of news coverage, of these major, major events that affect each and every one of us in some way, shape, or form. You could do a whole documentary just on that, Ruth.
Sure. Sure. No, and I think that's true. And I think the fact that that it was underreported, because perhaps, you know, as Liz said, you know, it didn't poll well. Well, it would poll well now if people had been reporting on it very well. But I think the very idea of that is a part of the machinations of the dismantling of our democracy.
Yeah.
Not reporting on something that affects at least half of our population, that makes no sense.
Right. Well, I mean,
for
my money, it's like I was very involved back in the 70s with the Equal Rights Amendment and the early 80s trying to get that passed. And it was so heartbreaking to fall, you know, short, even with the extension of time for the ERA, to fall short in 1982. And for my money, that told me right then that abortion was going to be an issue down the road. It was not.
Yeah.
Because there was so little regard when you couldn't get enough states to ratify the amendment. That told me what little regard there is for women and women, how they're perceived in the society and what they contribute to the society. And that includes their health care. That includes their rights when it comes to their own bodies. That includes their rights with work, with wages. And that, to me, was the handwriting on the wall for what was going to come down the pike if something wasn't done. And it would jeopardize Roe versus Wade, and that's exactly what has happened.
It is exactly what happened. And I think that right now we're definitely seeing the fallout. Not only are we seeing, obviously, women who are dying.
Yeah.
But we're seeing the economic impact of this on women and people with a uterus who are not able to pursue the life that they would like to have the careers that they would like to have without a choice about their own bodily autonomy, and how this so closely is interconnected to trans rights, to birth control, to all of those things. And, yeah. You know, we see with, you know, with Trump and Vance, we certainly see it's really transparent, right? It's mm-hmm. really transparent, not allowing women to do the work that they have, you know, gone to school for and trained for and all of these things. It's sort of like, take that away. I mean, look at Vance's own wife. She had a successful career as an attorney. I'm not going to go down that road, but you know.
No, we won't go down that road. But I'm on the same road with you there. But, you know, making this documentary, and one thing I noticed, you're from Philly, aren't you?
You know, did I detect that accent from you?
Yes, you did.
We can spy each other anywhere. Yes, I am from Philly. In fact, I just got back from there because I was canvassing, because Philly, you know, that's where we all look. Every election, we go to the suburbs of Philly. I went back to the belly of the beast to talk to people, canvassing, showing the film. But yes, I am from Philly.
Yeah, well,
proud.
See, it takes some, as I've always said to people, you can take the girl out of Philly, but you never take the Philly out of the girl.
That's right. I actually just posted something about that the other day. That is so true. We got the fight.
Yeah.
You know, Philly girls have the fight. And this is going to be a fight.
Yeah.
And while we're fighting, we have to laugh about it. We have to have levity and joy, because this is such a difficult fight.
Yeah.
And honestly, the irony of all of this is that it's just so preposterous that this would ever happen.
Yeah.
Right? So we also have to laugh about that in order to change it. And I love how unapologetic and unafraid people are being now around this, to say, no, this is not going to happen. We are not going back, like Kamala has to say. Mm-hmm. We're taking it back, and we're taking it back better, because Roe was the floor. Roe was not all encompassing.
No.
Roe was not, you know, helpful to low income and people of color. So we need something a lot more comprehensive than what we had. And I think we're going to build something better. But it's going to take everyone
the
fight.
And it's
going to
take time. It doesn't happen overnight. As we see with No One Asked You, you got involved. You came up with this great idea and shadowing Liz Winstead. And, you know, when Trump got elected. So you have been on this journey to make this documentary for almost 8 years now, if not a little bit longer. What amazes me is the amount of footage that you have. What amazes me is how you came up with a cohesive through line with everything that was transpiring and changing over the course of the making of this documentary. So I'm curious, for the filmmakers out there who are listening, your approach to telling this story, because this could not have been an easy film, number one, to collect footage on, number two, to edit, number three, to find a through line, given the changes that were happening politically and on the ground. Walk me through this.
Oh, well, thanks for all of that, because I have so here's what I will say to that. Yes, we had this is my eighth film. Mm-hmm. This is more footage than I've ever had. I am so passionate about this, because if I hadn't had the abortion that I had when I was 17 in Philly, leaving my, you know, giving myself a life, because I left a very abusive relationship at the time and picked up a camera at the time and figured out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. So if I hadn't had that, I would have never been as driven as I was. We had been so driven because this, you know, vote like your life is at stake, make a film like your life is at stake. That's really what this was. And in terms of all of the footage and media, not only did we have, you know, more media than I've ever had that we captured over this time, mm-hmm. but Liz being someone who makes media,
right.
we had all of that material. And then we had all of the material that was available to us from her being on MSNBC and all of the places
right.
that she is. So we had all of that to help tell the story. And it was a really complicated story to tell because she is our ambassador to meeting all of these different people.
Right.
And yet she's still at the center. And I would certainly say that although that she's at the center and she gives us entree to meeting all of these different people, many folks have said, and I think that this is really true, that the Pink House defenders and the clinic escorts and the frontline workers, they are really at the heart of the film because
yeah.
they are really and truly in our hearts, in us as filmmakers and in Liz, our main character's heart. So we had to do, you know, the task at hand editorially, which was very complicated, was tell the story. It's sort of in homage to Mr. Rogers and it's tell the story about the people who were helping the people mm-hmm. who needed the help.
Yeah.
And
the helpers.
So,
yeah.
And so that's really what we did. And also editorially, you know, sort of weaving together the story of Liz and her background, and, you know, she left it, amazing job as the co-creator of The Daily Show to forge a path as an activist and to really be, you know, singularly doing work with her organization that no one else was doing. And then to sort of bring that forward, and, you know, the media was underreporting. And so we had a really difficult task, which is make a film for, you know, editorially, make a film for people who think they know everything about what's going on, and not bore them, but entertain them while also teaching them about the things, educating them upon, you know, on the things that they don't know about what's happening. And then the people who are progressive, who've been checked out and don't know what's going on at all, and not make anyone feel bad, because we were making a film about the people who were sounding the alarm, that things were about to get much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was all, you know, the messaging that was happening for the past 10 or so years was falling upon deaf ears in America. And so to not make anyone feel badly, but to inspire them to, in the end, say, oh, well, I need to get involved in this fight. Here's 5 hours that I have in a month. I can write postcards to patients at clinics, or I can, people sort of discovering what they can do. Because I think one of the things that happened over the past at least couple years since Roe was overturned is I think that people were like looking at the situation going, wow, this is bigger than me. I can't possibly help it. So I'm just going to check out. And we want people to check back in by giving them you know, small measurable things that they can do. And so all of those things were really taken into account in a major way in our edit, because the worse things got, the more we had to bring the comedy back
yes.
in.
And you do that
as a foil.
You do that so well. And even early on in the documentary, and we're seeing Liz, she's doing stand up. And Liz being funny now is, this is something she always did, and you've got a lot of archival footage of Liz. You know, I love when she was introduced by Phyllis Diller. So we're going back, people.
Yeah.
Liz has always been a hot-button comedian. She has never, in her comedy, she has never shied away from crossing that line or walking that line on hot button issues, and you see that. But you break things up early, and you're very good. You and your editing team, so good at knowing when to break for laughter, for comedy, before you get so overwhelmed with what you're seeing with the clinicians and the staff at these clinics and what they're dealing with. And you can feel the intensity build as the documentary progresses. We see it on the faces of these workers, the haggard tiredness. You feel it comes through. We feel the burden that they have on their shoulders, that they're taking this so personally. And you reach a point where you let us sit with that for a while before giving us, you know, some light laughter, a release. And this pacing is so well done. It is so well done, Ruth.
Thank you.
You know, from a filmmaking standpoint, that impressed me so much. That you really, you and your team, Georgia, Alana, Shelley Westerman, you guys know. It must have taken forever to find that pacing, let alone a definitive through line. Because that's two different things that you're working with in editing. Your through line and your pacing. And you just did
an
amazing job.
Thank you for saying that. Thank you for saying that. I mean, we were really challenged by it, but we were really excited by the possibilities, you know, creatively, editorially. You know, Georgia and Alana were incredible editors. Shelley Westerman, who was our consulting editor, and Andrea Raby, who's one of our producers, who was a co-editor, who helped to sort of, you know, really keep it all together the whole time. And, you know, I mean, I appreciate all of the things that you're saying, I try to say this in the most humble way that I possibly can say it, is that, you know, I'm challenged by amazing stories like this. We really wanted to do it justice. We really wanted to do justice to the public, our audience who would see it. We don't want to ever, I feel like so many people underestimate their audience.
Yeah.
And we know that there's a bright audience out there that is always underestimated by the buyers and the programmers, mm-hmm. and the distributors and the streamers out there. We wanted to make the film that we felt like we needed in this country, that people didn't know that they needed, but they need it now.
Well, and you know, that
it brings people together. It's really a feel good movie in the theater.
You know, this is where your experience as a filmmaker, as a documentarian, comes into play. And it's something I try to impress upon first-time filmmakers, young filmmakers, is you've got to know who is your target audience? Who are you trying to reach? You know you're not going to reach every single person on the planet. So,
right.
You know, narrow it down. I actually did have a young director actually tell me once, no, I want, this is for everybody to see. Everyone's going to see it. Honey, everybody doesn't even see Marvel films. So, you know, rein it in. You know, pick. You know, narrow it down. You know your target audience. And that's a big part of your battle. And you really speak to the target audience, but you do so in such a way that even word of mouth is going to make people that may not normally see this documentary, they're going to want to see it. And that's
a gift. I think the thing that you said about audience is really important because, you know, there's all of this conversation about preaching to the choir and not preaching to the choir. Here's the thing. This film really is for a lot of people who are pro-choice, mm-hmm. who don't realize that they need to be pro-abortion in order to be pro-choice. But there are a lot of white progressive women who think that they're going to be fine, and they probably will be fine, and they need to understand that abortion care was there for them when they needed it, and it is their responsibility, just like it is the responsibility of men who have benefited from abortions, to be there until it is safe and legal and affordable for everyone. And I think that and unfortunately or fortunately, that's a huge audience, right?
Yeah.
That's a huge audience of progressives. We're not going to move the people who are, you know, religious extremists.
Right.
We're not going to reach those. We're not going to reach those people in a lot of ways. And that's fine. You know, but the people who do agree with us, they need to be engaged. And I think that's the way. I mean, it's not in the film, but Liz talks a lot about, you know, Park Slope peanut allergy moms who said, oh, yeah, I got an abortion to Planned Parenthood when I was in college, but I didn't think about it after that. It's for a lot of them. And you know what? There's a lot of them.
Yeah. There are a lot of them. A lot of them. You know, a question for you. At what point, because of the fact that you kept accumulating shooting and because things really started ramping up, you know, with Trump's appointees to SCOTUS and, you know, subsequently Roe being overturned by Dobbs, at what point did you realize that the Pink House was going to be the heartbeat, a real heartbeat in this documentary?
All along, we knew that it was possible, so we stayed with them. We would go back to all of the different clinics that we filmed in 2017. But it became clear that it was either going to be Missouri, Ohio, Texas, or Mississippi that were going to be, that was going to be one of the states, the state to overturn Roe. And so we were following them. Fortunately for us, you know, Kim and Dorinda and the Pink House defenders were, you know, incredible characters.
Oh, my God. You know, they were amazing. Amazing. But, you know, through it all, you never took your eye off of the viewpoint of the workers, of the clinicians. No matter what was happening, you didn't let us forget them. The people that were doing the work that everybody seemed to forget about. They weren't politicians. They weren't court justices. But they were the people actually in harm's way in many instances. And I'm so glad you'd never lost sight of that throughout this documentary.
Thank you. You know, I have so much love and admiration and respect for them. I mean, these are people who modified or gave up their day jobs in order to have a full-time career as a volunteer. And I just have so much, you know, love and admiration and respect for those people who did that, because they really and truly have been on the front lines trying to fight for all people in America who need health care.
Yeah. Because that's actually what it comes down to. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was just, you know, it was really important to us to do them justice and to do justice to all of them. And that includes Liz and Abortion Access Front, who worked, you know, so tirelessly this, you know, for, you know, Liz started the organization now 10 years ago at this point. It was so important to honor that, because it was critical to her that this was really needed, and it needed to be highlighted. And, you know, when the idea came to me, it was so clear that the work that Abortion Access Front did, with Liz as, you know, a very strong critic of you know, politics and media, at the center of that, to sort of, you know, really steady the boat along the way and provide facts.
Yeah.
Along with the humor.
And that's what, that's, you know, that's why I said earlier, you know, this educates and entertains. And of course, people like visual aids and I burst out laughing with, you have one animation segment here. You got an animation happening. The animation segment just made me crack up. I got to say, it was highly entertaining.
Aw. Yeah, the animators who did that work were incredible. Astral Studios in Brooklyn are awesome.
You break up, and the beauty here is you don't have talking heads with sit-down question and answers, which many filmmakers, I'm sure, would have been inclined if they were to do a documentary of this nature, on this subject matter. That's what they would have done. Just a sit-down, talking heads. You have life happening.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a cinema verite filmmaker. I love to do verite scenes. And so we did do interviews, and we use them for connective tissue.
Yep.
But for the most part, it is a verite, let it unfold kind of film. And I think one of the things that's really the difference, for an audience and how, I mean, I know you know this, but the difference for how it permeates and, affects an audience is that when you see things unfold like that versus interviews, mm-hmm. The lion's share of interviews, it feels a lot more, it is in the sort of traditional direct cinema, cinema verite ways of doing things. It is to the audience, gives the audience the feeling that they were there, not the feeling that they were told about something after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because I want an audience to feel like they are there. I want the audience to feel like they understand what it's like to stand next to Dorinda Hancock outside of the Pink House when she is being harassed by, extremists.
Yeah.
I want the audience to feel that.
What you give us with No One Asked You is life. You immerse us in this chapter of life. There is life happening all around, no matter what side of the fence people are on, and how people can rise up, how they can stand up for themselves, for others. You immerse us in life. It's like walking down Broad Street in the middle of the afternoon, or trying to cross it and darting between all the cars.
And somebody giving you a finger, because happen.
That goes without saying. That doesn't even need qualification. My God, Ruth.
That's when I feel like I'm at home.
Oh, I still, when I drive, I always, that finger pops up. Well, I can't help it. It's just, it's genetic, I think. It's just ingrained. But this, you immerse us in life with this documentary, and we feel an experience. We are there. You got what you wanted. That's what you wanted. You gave us that. And that's any filmmaker who can do that, you've done, it's a job well done.
Thank you so much. I mean, I really appreciate that you're saying that, because I would not be talking to you right now if I hadn't had an abortion in Philadelphia when I was a teenager and been able to carry on the life that I have as someone who is a storyteller and who can bring these kinds of stories to an audience. It's so important to me. And I, as a white woman who is definitely an ally and understands what is really at stake, I think I really feel like that's my calling. I feel like it's my responsibility. I was able to move on with my life, and I want to be able to, through the making of this film and through people sharing this film, help others insist that abortion needs to be safe and legal and affordable and accessible to everyone. And that's a really important message that we want to get out there in order to really turn the tide of where we are right now.
And a lot's, what's going to happen come November 5th? How do you do you see yourself doing another documentary on this subject or something else, depending on what happens with the election?
Well, right now, we're actually doing a finish of, there's an epilogue, so there's been some things that have updated. So we're opening theatrically this week in New York, and then we're going to go across the country. We're trying to screen in every state, but we have like 30 screenings set up between now and the election. It's nuts. And a theatrical run in New York, which is an awards qualifying run. We're like the little guy. Mm-hmm. In the big sea of all of these films that are out there. And so one thing I will tell you that's really important is that there's some updates and in the film, in our epilogue, and Abortion Access Front and Liz do a really good job of identifying some of these Christian national extremists who were out at the clinic harassing women, and maybe they turn them in. And maybe something happened. I'll tell you. You'll have to see the updated epilogue version of the film. And so, no, I don't plan to make another film about this right now, because we have a very robust impact and engagement and distribution plan mm-hmm. for the film. We're going to be streaming on Jolt Film starting the 25th of October, so people will be able to stream it before the election. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important to understand for your listeners to understand that that no matter what happens on November 5th, and everybody does need to go out and vote all the way down the ballot around this, because we need supporters and people who support and clearly support abortion, you know, at every level. No matter what happens, things are not going to get better overnight. And so this is a long haul. And so even if Kamala wins and we win every, you know, body in the House and the Senate, we still need, and, you know, even if we stack the Supreme Court, all of those things, it's going to take some time. And this is a long fight. So we'll be out there with the film, doing impact work where it's needed most in underserved communities, raising awareness and showing people what they can do, both in the on the activism front of things, but also in how to help others, you know, the people in your life, if you know that they need abortion care. So to make everyone in America really aware of their self-advocacy, really. And so that's what our plans are for the film. So when you make a film like this, you have to commit to the time to do the impact work around it mm-hmm. in order for it to really have an effect. You know, I didn't start out as an activist when I started out being a filmmaker. I was really just sort of a social documentary photographer and mm-hmm. then filmmaker, but I became an activist over time, and I plan to use this in all of the ways that I can to raise awareness. We're out on the road a little bit with Women for Harris. We were just in Philly, and we're going to Michigan and Georgia and some other places, all of the places that really need to make sure that when people go to the ballot that they are voting for all pro-choice candidates.
But, and you know, it's you know, and even if people are not, you know, voting for pro-choice candidates, people have to remember, you've got to vote all the way down, because yes, you can vote for the president, the vice presidential ticket, but Congress, you have to think about Congress and who's sitting in those chairs. And I know so many people, I know people that do not vote for congressional seats.
They have to this time around.
It's very important. And, you know, and I know who I would like you to vote for, but as long as you go vote and go all the way down the ticket, because the presidents, they can just sit there and be lame ducks if they don't have Congress behind them, and vice versa. So very important. Now, no one asked you, doc.com Will you be posting updates for where the film is screening?
Yes, we are posting things every day. So please go to our website. Please follow the film. And please, you know, go to our socials, share it. We have a brand new trailer that we just launched. Share it widely because we really want to make a big splash with this film right now before the election, so that after the election, people can roll up their sleeves and figure out what they want to do to help turn the tide.
Yeah. Ruth, this has been so spectacular having you on the show. You have to come back.
I'm coming back. We need to be in touch because I need to talk to you about all the Philly things.
Oh, absolutely. Ariane can give you all of my contact info.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate
it. This has been spectacular. And again, Jolt, I didn't even know about the streaming service, Jolt. You educated me on a new streaming service today. So everybody, starting on the 24th or 25th, everybody can watch. No One Asked You There. In the meantime, go to the website, noneaskedyoudoc.com, and see everywhere that the film is screening. So you can go see it. You will be entertained and educated at the same time. And it's not too often I can say that about a film. So, Ruth, thank you. Thank you so, so much. And we will be in touch.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Okay, Ruth, you have a great day.
Right. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And yes, this is a problem when Philly people start talking. We keep talking. All right, now, as promised, we're going to go back and we're going to pick up my exclusive interview with Michael Felker on Things Will Be Different. And he just started talking about their lookup table, which are called LUTs, L-U-T-S, possessive or plural. And that is for color purposes. And color is very important in Things Will Be Different, as you're going to hear us talk about now.
Carissa, myself, and the team over at Apache Color in Los Angeles, and we did camera tests with at Carissa's house with like our producers and family that were visiting, just to like really understand how light comes through windows, and just only letting light, the main source of light, be like overcast coming from windows. And then that's how we figured out our cold color palette. And then we went outside and dealt the harsh, like, sunlight, and then figured out the warm, sticky color palette for the summer. And then we used those to then put into the camera while we shot. So while we were shooting, we weren't looking at, like, a flat color image. We were looking at the first pass of color already to know that this was not only looking good and looking correct and feeling good, but it also gave a big boost to our actors and our crew to see, like, whoa, that already looks great. So we had a lot of color choices we made beforehand, and then we were able to fine-tune it in post once we got the edit lock in and went back to Apache Color House for finishing.
Here again, you're using color and establishing contrast and differentials.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was so key. We needed to have it feel like winter and feel like summer, because the ultimate magic trick of the movie is just to make sure that we know time has passed, or we have changed places even though we're at the same location, by going from like walking into a closet door and then walking back out. And if that didn't work, then the movie would feel cheap or flat, or mm-hmm. we would lose them 10 minutes in. And I feel like a lot of that has to do with how we shape the movie in color.
Well, and the color also adds so much in terms of the house itself, the farmhouse itself, with those old, darker woods. Because it adds a real richness. You're not flattening any of the natural ambiance of the house out.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up like visiting my family farm in Michigan, and there's just not a lot of lights. Like, there's not a lot of lamps or lights overhead. It's just farmhouses that are really old are lit by daylight coming from windows.
Mm-hmm.
So to have the movie feel like the only lights that are on are just an overbearing, like, gray overcast, or like a muddy, warm, sticky summer sun, and just letting it pour into the room gives the room so much more atmosphere and lets dust play, lets antiques and furniture like have a new shape and light sitting there. It's it was really important to have that feeling I had when I visited the farmhouse as a kid in this movie, for sure.
And I'm glad that you brought up with the sun coming through the windows and the dust. I always loved growing up when the sun would come through my window and I could just lay there and look at the little particles within the light.
Yeah, there's a magic to watching just like how a sunrise and a sunset just pour through a window and you just feel like, you know, the elements of inside of a lived-in space or an unlived-in space dance in the sunlight. It's really quite amazing.
Yeah. Another big element here is also your music, your score, Michael Muller's score. What were you looking for musically with this
film? That was a lot of collaboration with our two composers, Jimmy Laval and Michael A. Muller. Basically, what we were looking for was I wanted a movie to feel melancholic and a little bit haunting, but also just like, just this tinge of sadness between the family. And it came from a lot of like pulls of temp music that I'd used as an editor for the last 10 years. Like I have a huge library of temp music that I've used and, you know, figured out which ones are the ones that are overplayed, but which ones are the ones that are like personal favorites and not used enough. And just, I think the key was using like, what if we had old like instruments, like, you know, a cello, a bass, a piano, and then sitting inside a farmhouse, and everything was slightly out of tune or slightly warped, and then using that as the base for a lot of this music. So while we do have like an intense like sci-fi element of sounds and stuff like that during the intense moments, it's the sad moments between the brother and sister or the parts where we are watching time pass that speak to me the most, which is where the movie just like has like a lived inside feel, like the whole orchestra has been inside this farmhouse and is also just playing its feelings.
A really nice compliment to help set the tone, and because you feel the history with that house.
Oh my gosh, yes. We knew going into that house that it actually was once a town that had actually failed to be a town, because there's about six buildings on that property that all served different functions for a town, like a post office, a mill grain farm, a silo, like a giant like barn for animals, and it just didn't take off. So you could tell where everything had been tried in like hundreds and 200 years ago to be a functioning like hub for people in the area. And then time passed them by. Now it's a rustic wedding venue, so it's got a lot of love and a lot of people coming through and using the space. But it definitely has a charm and a sense of history that, to me, plays like time travel. When you look at, like out the window and you see how the glass is warped, or if you look at, like, the wood on the floor and you see scratch marks, you time travel to where that was when it was new and what happened to that wood or how this glass got slowly warped over time. It's the magic of that type of time travel is nostalgia and warping there to when it was contemporary.
Just job so well done, Michael. And I got one last question for you before I let you go. So you can finish prepping for your premiere.
I got plenty of time for you. Thank you so much.
I'm curious, what did you learn? First time feature narrative, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker and storyteller that you can now take forward into your future projects?
It's funny. I've had this lesson on other things, but it's so double down, triple down after doing a feature. You know, as a kid, when you're watching, like, the great movies and, you know, the great auteur-driven movies, you think it's so, like, look at inside this brain of this one person who helped shape this vision and the team that helped create it. But for me, like, so much more in this movie, this was such a collaborative team family effort. Like, I see a director now as, like, a football coach. It's like, we have a plan. I wrote down plays, but you guys are all the players on the field making those plays work and executing them in the way that happens, like, the way in order for us to score. Like, and I know that sounds really, really, like, basic, but it is true. And you're trying to keep the morale up. You're trying to keep everyone going. You're trying to encourage people because they're bringing so much of their artistic stamp and their vision to everything they do, from the costume designer, the production designer, the makeup artist, the director of photography, the editor, they're all bringing their stamp to put onto the movie and really wanting to have their voice in it too. And it's the job of like a director to like not only get what the story is, but also make their stamps and their contributions feel heard to make it even better than you imagined. And so the biggest thing I learned is that making a movie is like being with a family. And I want to work with more and more people, but I also want to work with people who really care so much on each movie like this one did, and not just be in my own head, because what I have in my own head is nice and fine, I think, but the movie's going to be so much better when you work with a great, talented crew who really cares, and it's just the sweetest people in the world.
Well, as I said, job well done, Michael. Where is the premiere tonight?
We are at the Culver Theater in Culver City. So we'll be... it's like right a little outside of like south of Santa Monica.
Yeah, you're down the street from me.
Oh, awesome. Very cool. Yeah, we're going to do our premiere there, and then we'll have our opening week theater run here, which will be at the Snow Lounge on Sunset and the Alamo Draft House in downtown.
This has been fabulous, Michael, and I hope we get to do this again in the future.
Oh, you bet. 100%, Debbie.
Get to work on a sequel for me. I want a sequel.
All right. Here I go. Pull up my laptop. Here I go.
Thanks so much, Michael. Bye-bye. All right.
Bye-bye. Have a good one.
And that was Michael Felker, writer-director, Things Will Be Different. And here's an update for you on Things Will Be Different. I just got the blast while we were on the air, as a matter of fact. Things Will Be Different will be on Blu-ray and digital November 18th. So if you miss it in the theater, because it is still in theaters, mark November 18th on your calendar. It'll make a great Christmas gift for someone. Not saying who, but it'll make a great Christmas gift for someone. You got to start thinking about Christmas gifts now, people, with Blu-rays, DVDs, and all those extra commentaries and bonus features that you get, which Things Will Be Different does have bonus features on. It will have bonus features on the DVD or the Blu-ray. So that is all the time we have again today. Yeah, we went late again. Next week, it's a full house next week as Vivian Kerr is going to be joining us at the top of the show to talk about Seance. And then I'm going to have the two filmmakers from Alien Country joining us at the midpoint of the show. Needless to say, things get a little spooky and creepy next week just before Halloween. And then rounding out the month, what better way to celebrate Halloween week? Jane Clark is going to be back with me talking about her new film, Witchy Ways. Does that say Halloween or what? All right, guys, that is all the time we have for today. I'll be back next week, but until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.